Hello and welcome to the Barton Legal Podcast. I'm Bill Barton, a solicitor who lives and breathes construction and engineering law. At Barton Legal, we help clients in the UK and around the world on everything from litigation and arbitration to drafting and negotiating contracts. And in this podcast, we unpack the latest legal trends and problems facing the industry, providing you with straight-talking insights to help break down these complex legal questions. So, let's get on with today's episode. Hello everybody, I'm Bill Barton from Barton Legal, and this is another episode of the Barton Legal Podcast. Today I'm joined by Brendan Grenier. He's a District Associate Judge at Iowa Courts in the good old US of A. I was fortunate to meet Brendan first online because he was watching one of our webinars, and then he came to London and we met in person, and it shows how dynamic and broad the law is. That I'm a construction lawyer, but Brendan alighted on our webinars, found them interesting. Since then, he's spoken on one of our webinars, and I hope that we regard ourselves as friends. He's a fascinating guy, and here he is today. We're joined virtually, and I think you must be, what, 5-6 hours behind us, Brendan?
6 hours behind. It is 7 a.m. where I...
So 7 a.m. peeps. So for me, it's just gone one. So yeah, so it's a big commitment. Anyway, Brendan, would you like to please introduce yourself in... Well, just introduce yourself, you know, tell us, you know, something about yourself, what you do. I think it's always better when it comes from you rather than me. You know, I've got a load of research just sort of parroting lots of things.
Thank you, Bill. And it's been an absolute pleasure to become your friend over these last couple of years. You and I had a mutual acquaintance. You were more of a friend with Paul Darling, and we met virtually through Paul. And I got to know Paul during one of my visits in Windsor at a conference hosted by Middle Temple. And Paul was just an absolute delight and friendly individual. He sadly passed away shortly after I met him. But nevertheless, he created this connection between you and me. And that's great. So what a nice little legacy, besides the amazing legacy that he left for the legal profession and for the UK in general. So cheers to Paul. I am a district associate judge in Polk County, Iowa, which is in Des Moines, the capital of Iowa. And I've been sitting as a judge for about 6.5 years now, primarily in the criminal courts with some child welfare cases and small claims appeals as well. When a Brit asks me about my jurisdiction and the cases I hear, the way I explain it is that it is a mash of the English and Welsh Magistrates Court and the Crown Court. So on any day, I might be sitting in a courtroom that resembles the Magistrates Court, high volume sort of cases, lots of drunken and disorderly sort of matters, bar fights, drunk driving, drug offenses, small theft. But then I'm also tasked with sitting on jury trials and sometimes felony cases, such as the occasional burglary or more serious injury assault, and a number of other matters, and like I said, child welfare cases, and sometimes the appeals as well. Before I became a judge, I was a prosecutor for about 11 years, and I handled a lot of white-collar crime and vehicular homicides for the last few years of my practice. Here we have salaried full-time prosecutors. So I was both the solicitor and the advocate for all of the cases that I handled. So case would come in, I would build it up and charge the case much like a solicitor. And then I would also take that same file myself and go and advocate for it in the district court and then do the jury trial. And so I did that for 11 years. Before that, I was in law school, the American Law School, which is 3 years, at Drake University, also here in Des Moines, Iowa. My undergraduate university was a 4-year degree from Iowa State University in Ames, Iowa, which is just north of here. And I did that for 4 years. So that's a little bit about me. I was born and raised here in Des Moines, and now I get to sit as a judge in Des Moines. And that's a pretty special privilege.
And a great summary. So to cater for my range of audience, so is American law, you know, very Ally McBeal or Lincoln Lawyer? No, I don't know if you've actually watched those. Who would you rather be?
I think it's of those two, it's probably closer to Lincoln Lawyer.
Although we're still waiting for the next series here, so I think the last one I saw, I think the boot was opened and he had a dead body in the back. So I don't know if you're more advanced in the state. So I'm not suggesting you're putting people in your boot.
I've only watched the Lincoln Lawyer movie with Matthew McConaughey, so I haven't watched that. Now, I will say one show that did American law justice was Better Call Saul.
Oh, love that.
And I only say that in so much as the courtroom scenes, by and large, besides some of his antics, were pretty spot on. And I think in the first season, there was a montage of Saul, I think he was going by Jimmy at that time, where he is working in the district court as a contract defense attorney, and he is going in between cases, and he's got dozens and dozens of clients that he's juggling, and he's trying to settle those cases and as best he can. And I remember that thinking, oh, that is an absolutely accurate portrayal of what it's like to be a criminal attorney, especially the criminal defense attorney in the United States. So that would be, I think, a better reference. And it's a good show too.
It is a belter. We've had very few in this country. You'd have to go back to Crown Court, and there's a few others. There was one, I think, called Park Square that was actually based in Leeds. But very few English law series have ever even remotely resembled. And it's partly because our profession is split. We don't come across as interesting and, you know, sexy and different and vibrant as you do, because as solicitors, generally, we just sort of sat in our office and we meet clients, and then all the exciting stuff is apparently done by barristers. And you know, you met Paul, and so he's interesting, or he, you know, interesting, vibrant, but no one wants to talk to his instructing solicitor. And I think that's why in the UK we have a diet of USA shows. So you've sort of, as you say, you've grown up, you spent your career in Iowa. How difficult is it to move between states as an attorney in the USA? You know, if you decided, you know, you're fed up with the winters in Iowa and you just fancy, you know, taking up surfing, like you might already surf, and you're going to move to California, how difficult do you have to redo the bar exam? And is that very difficult, or is there recognition between states?
So that's a very good question. I think it used to be more difficult. It is becoming easier, but it is dependent on the state. For example, Iowa has what we call reciprocity with 26 other states, New York, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Illinois, Minnesota, so forth. And so if I were to go to one of those states after practicing here for 2 or 3 years, I'd be able to qualify as a lawyer in those jurisdictions. California is unique because it doesn't share reciprocity with any state, except that in many states, if you qualify as a lawyer in California, you can then transfer that to another state, but not in reverse. And California has a notoriously difficult bar exam, so I think that's part of the reason why they kind of hold themselves up as that. Yeah. The states are moving towards a more universal approach to the bar exam. So the bar exam that they're going to be taking here in Iowa in a couple of years is going to be the same as it is in New York or in Virginia or some of the other states. And so once you've established that the bar exam is the same and the criteria you use to qualify a lawyer is universal, then I think we're going to move towards more reciprocity with more states. That's where it sits right now, though.
And do you think that having a unified exam is actually going to be possible? I only ask because, you know, everyone becomes very precious, doesn't they? And sort of, our exam is better than your exam, as you're saying about California. So, you know, will you all have to sort of, a number of you states, sit down and say, right, we're all going to morph towards the one that's closer to Iowa's or New York's? Or will it end up being, you know, a real blend, do you think?
I don't know if I have an opinion on that. What I will say is that the bar exam, I don't believe, tests how good you will be as a lawyer. It tests whether you can answer a number of difficult questions under time constraints and pressure. But I don't see that as a reflection of whether you're going to be a good lawyer in the end.
And I think that's a very interesting cross point, because we now have a new exam for qualifying lawyers. I can't remember what it's. It might just be solicitor's qualification exam, but it's called SQE, and it's split into two parts. And the first part is this, you know, massive multiple choice that I think is either 2 or 3 hours long. It's only been in a couple of years. The pass rates are poor. And there's a wide discrepancy. So basically, if you're white male, your chances of passing that are something like 70%. If you're not a white male, if you're a woman, if you have any sort of disability, your chances plummet. But it's, yeah, 2-3 hours long. And from speaking to people, multiple choice, but you barely have time to think. It's just sort of read it, tick an answer. And you're quite right. How are we actually preparing lawyers for the future? Because I don't think that equips people. And do you see that when you're sitting in court? Have you seen over the, you know, 6.5 years, but you've also got that comparison of when you were a prosecutor, and you must have had a view of the defense lawyers and how good or bad they were. Is quality getting better, worse? Are there certain things, you know, perhaps their preparation is more detailed because everyone's got computers, but what about sort of presentation skills and things like that?
I'd say that the presentation skills are declining. I wouldn't say that the lawyers are less prepared, but the level of advocacy isn't the same as it was when I qualified as a lawyer. So that's where mentorship could come in and fill in the gap and make a lawyer who is new and just trying out their hand at criminal cases. A newly qualified American lawyer with a good mentor could become a very good lawyer in the long run. I see a lack of mentorship right now, and so that's where I think the decline is.
And is that because there's no sort of formal mentoring schemes, or just people don't have the time to or inclination to take sort of juniors, or perhaps as in this country? Sorry, loads and loads of questions. Is it because Well, what's the proportion of in-person cases to, do you do virtual hearings?
Most of my hearings are in-person, the vast majority. I don't do very many that are virtual. So it's there are a number of factors to it. I can point to a couple. I see a lot of newly qualified lawyers going out on their own and starting their own law practice. And so they don't answer to a supervisor. They don't answer to a senior partner. They are answering only to themselves. So there's a lack of mentorship there. There's also just the volume of cases is increasing and is much, much higher, in part because of the same issues that you were experiencing in England and Wales, where fewer and fewer lawyers are taking on criminal cases. We have plenty of prosecutors, but very few and declining numbers in contract lawyers. We have a fair amount of public defenders. Now, what I will say about the public defenders here in Iowa is I think they tend to be of a higher quality because of the mentorship within their office structures. So they have a supervisor, and then they have more senior lawyers that are working in the offices. And that just creates an environment where they can talk about cases and exchange ideas and come up with strategies on how to approach problems.
And yeah, I think you need that, don't you? You need that constructive criticism as well as support, and you need that ability just to tag along. I think when I qualified, I must have been to, well, hundreds of, I suspect being an exaggeration, but dozens and dozens of hearings with my various sort of bosses, both in my 2 year as an article clerk, but then subsequently, where, you know, I wasn't really providing any function. You know, I carried a bag very efficiently, and I could hand over documents and look really, you know, really quite intelligent, which is, there's a strain. But you weren't really doing anything else. But that's a pressure now, isn't it? The clients don't want to pay, and law firms are under greater pressure to make every minute of people's time pay. And so it's harder for people just to go and experience, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And now my courtrooms are set up in such a way that I have what's called an anti-courtroom, where the prosecutors and defense attorneys sit with the clients and talk about the cases. Then there's a wall with a door, and then the actual courtroom. So nobody is in the back of the courtroom watching what the proceedings, how the proceedings are going, and watching other lawyers. They're not getting that experience from seeing what works with other lawyers and what doesn't. Everything is isolated, and you're called into the courtroom individually, and then you make your case, and then you leave, and there's no audience.
Right.
So that's another problem that we've kind of created for ourselves.
And do you think, is that an intractable problem, or is that something that can be changed? What do you gain when you've come to the UK and you've looked at sort of the way in which we conduct law? Does that help you think there's some good things, some bad, you know, does it help to show the great things that you're doing? And do you think there should be more exchange in that way between the fact we're different jurisdictions? What does that matter?
That is a very good question. I see a lot of the same problems that we have. I think it comes down to funding and interest. So some of these problems can be fixed if the powers that be decided that they wanted to invest. With younger lawyers that are just starting out, they're not getting paid very well. There's not an incentive to take those cases. So they're more incentivized to move on to other practices. And so, you know, right when they get to a point where they are comfortable in their shoes and in the criminal arena, they move on, because there's a practice that's more profitable.
Yeah.
private pay clients and whatnot, family law can pay the bills better, or maybe they go and work in corporate law. So that's a similarity, I think, between the two jurisdictions. It would be helpful if we could all sit down and talk about solutions together. I don't pretend to know what all of the solutions are, but I think if the judges and the politicians in my jurisdiction were to sit and talk to the ones in your jurisdiction, we could probably come up with similar schemes on how to resolve those issues. What I want to go back, though, to the point about the solicitor's qualifying exam, because you know that I took that exam.
Yeah, you did.
And taking the exam itself was a nightmare, absolute nightmare. It was 2 days, and it was I think a total of 6 hours, maybe 360 questions, though.
Yeah.
But studying for the exam absolutely made me a better lawyer and a better judge.
Yes.
And I enjoyed that part of qualifying. So the qualification was nice, and I was proud of that. But it really was in the sitting down and studying the law that made me a better judge and a better lawyer. In part because there are, as you know, we are both common law jurisdictions. Thank you. You gave us our common law through William
Blackstone.
It's
a pleasure.
Yes. So William Blackstone, you know, writes the commentaries, and Benjamin Franklin says, hey, those are really great. And he starts printing thousands of copies in Philadelphia. And then here we are, a common law jurisdiction. But there are common law principles that I didn't learn in law school that I learned from studying the SQE,
okay,
especially with the maxims of equity and with the rules of statutory construction. Those aren't things that are taught in American law schools, but still have an application here in the United States. And I've definitely used both equity and rules of statutory construction in my practice as a judge. And so that was quite beneficial. I'd love to say I could come and fix some of your advocacy issues, but I don't think I'm qualified to do that. So I can tell you that I've benefited from it, from that exchange.
Yeah. I think it's an interesting point you make, and I've talked to some other people about this, the process of learning. Do you think that because you sought to become dual qualified, but later in your career, do you think that's something that actually that's the benefit? It's, as you say, it's not the qualification, which you worked incredibly hard for and deserved, but the process, as you say, the process, because within that, you're rediscovering all those simple principles that actually you've forgotten. Because as we progress through our career, all that sort of straightforward stuff is, you're just taken for granted, aren't you? That people don't ask you. So going back over things helps, and you've got a wider understanding, haven't you, from your career?
Well, and it's not just going over the principles that I'd forgotten, but learning something completely new that I should have learned in the first place. And maybe perhaps I did forget some of those things because I've been focused in one area of the law for so much of my career, the elements of contracts, the elements of negligence, and my gosh, your property law is just so very bizarre and
yeah,
fascinating. Approaching it in later on in the career was definitely something that was an advantage. I don't think I could have done this as a newly qualified lawyer in the United States.
Right.
Doing it 15, 16 years after I qualified made me appreciate it more than when I was studying for the American bar exam.
Yeah.
And I can say that because, in part because there was more at stake when I was studying for the American bar exam. My entire career was on the line.
Yeah.
And so there was pressure to learn the material. Now, you know, I have an established career. If I pass the SQE, great. If I fail, great. I'm still in the same position, right? So it became more enjoyable to learn these things, and it was fun. And people think that is a bizarre thing to say, but you know, having sat now for two bar exams, I would happily do the second one all over again if I needed, because I just enjoyed the process, because it opened up the law to me and gave me a perspective that I didn't know that I needed in my career. So I tell everybody that they should give it a shot.
Well, I was going to say you did it for fun, and but you really were, and I think you're right that as I get older, I am fascinated by the differences and similarities between different jurisdictions and approaches, because you do gain insights from lawyers. We're all lawyers or solicitors, attorneys, whatever you want to use as a sort of common phrase, and yet we all have different approaches, but we've all had to study in a comparable way of, you know, at whatever time you entered the law, even if you came in later in life and did sort of conversion course, you'll have to have learned about cases and the application, you know, and finding out what was the true meaning and the decision and all the rest. And yet there nevertheless seems a lack of inclination, a lack of encouragement for people to exchange ideas. I talk to people, and I mentioned to you before, we had the California Lawyers Association, and people said to me, well, why are you doing anything with them? What's the purpose? What's the point? I said, well, you know, it's not about, you know, getting work. It's about having different ideas or having to explain a point of our law. Because someone says, well, why do you do it that way? And then you think, well, it's a great question, isn't it? You know, and we do so many things just out of habit, but
to that point, you know, for the last few years, I've come to be a part of a training with the barristers at Middle Temple, and it's a Crown Court advocacy training for a qualifying session. And one of the parts that they always ask me to do is to do a comparison on closing speeches. Mm. And so I do a half hour, and then there's a Silk who does a half hour as well. And so I demonstrate what a closing argument in America looks like. And the looks on the masters of who are there and the aspiring barristers is one of both of amazement and horror. Why on earth would you ever do that? And I tried to at least explain my thought process in connecting with the jury during a closing speech. We call it a closing argument. The way that we use the entire courtroom as a stage, and the use of inflection in our voices and during certain parts of the presentation. I also use PowerPoint in all of my closing arguments and speeches, which is virtually unheard of here.
Totally unheard of.
And I'm trying to convey the advantages of that and at least plant the seed that maybe there's a different way of doing that in England and Wales. Likewise, though, I've learned a lot, and I feel like I have terrible imposter syndrome when I sit and watch a very good Silk make a closing speech. It is It is a work of art in advocacy.
But they're very different. You know, I don't really understand why, for example, in our closings, you couldn't have reference to a PowerPoint or other documentation. They used during the trial. I can't, you know, off the top of my head, I can't really see why a judge, if he said, well, actually, I'm going to this closing and here's a flip chart or something. I can't see a judge actually saying, well, I'm terribly sorry, you know, Mr. or Ms. So-and-so, I couldn't possibly allow you to do that. But we have this, we've got an entrenched view, haven't we? And as you said, unless you change that view, I think it's often there's, we have, it's the old phrase, isn't it? There's more in, we have more in common than people think, but you've got to work at finding that commonality. And I love the fact that in the time I've known you, it's made me think of different ways. And it's also made me think about changing presentation sort of ideas. And then I've learned, you know, I lecture on the University of Leeds, do the law side for engineers. And, God, you know, I'm there lecturing and I'm reading some of this stuff and thinking, oh, is that really? You know, I was just thinking, I'd forgotten completely. And you ask, somebody asks you a question, don't they? And I'm a big believer in it. In your head, you've got an answer. And then you open your mouth and you're thinking, I bet this just sounds rubbish. And then I pause at the end and I'm thinking, please, someone, just say, oh, that's really helpful. You know. But when they say, oh, well, I don't really understand that. Oh, God, you know, it's like I'm going to have to think of something else. But I don't want this to be just about one-dimensional because you have other skills. So I want to spend a little bit of time about your homemade sauce. And this might seem frivolous, but this is because I love the fact that people pigeonhole us. I don't know if you have that phrase in America, but, you know, they put you into a pigeonhole. And then that's how they see you. Now, you know, I don't think of a judge as being, you know, making homemade sauce. So how did that come about? Were you challenged? Was there a competition at, you know, one of your kids' schools? Did your wife say, you know, you just can't cook? And you thought, right, I'll show you.
Well, she still believes I can't cook.
And you're keeping that a secret that you can't.
Well, it's true. A few Christmases ago, my wife gave me a fermentation kit. It's just a jar with a weight and a little bubbler on top of it. And you know, it had some instructions on how to make hot sauce, only because I enjoyed dousing my food in it. I learned some recipes and I started going to some of our Mexican grocers here in town, and I found that you can get pounds and pounds of jalapenos for just a few dollars. And so I would bring them back. I'd bring a 3 or 4 pound bag of jalapenos back to the house, chop them up, throw them in the glass jar with some salt and let it go for a few weeks. And then I'd pulse it up, bottle it, and well, no one in my house eats hot sauce besides me, so I'd be passing it off to my colleagues and my friends to see if they liked it. And they'd say, yeah, I like this one, you know, with this flavoring. I like the green one more than the red one and so forth. And so it just became a hobby, and I'd pass them along. And sometimes it would work, sometimes it wouldn't. But it became a lot of fun. I learned a lot about the fermentation process, and it's a fun little hobby to have. And I've got a few jars of it sitting on my kitchen counter right now.
Well, make sure you bring. I think our rules are slightly more relaxed than the States. Make sure you bring some with you in October. And giving things like that out creates an incredible connection, doesn't it? We use a charity to plant trees to offset carbon footprint, which obviously with the travel I do is quite a lot. And I noticed they had beehives. And so a couple of years ago, we said to the people there, look, you know, how about if we effectively sponsor your beehives so that you can afford to keep them? Because it's always a difficulty. And now we have a load of honey. So yeah, we have little pots of honey that we give to people. And it's people love it. And it's, again, it's just totally different, isn't it?
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I didn't know that. And
I'll do your swaps. I'll bring you some honey.
Let's do it, yeah. When you come to Iowa in February.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll hide it in my coat. Yeah. So what about, you know, as a judge, do you have more or less time, you know, do you have than when you were a prosecutor? So does that give you more time for interests and pastimes and just, are you more a sort of go out and do active, or are you more art gallery or theatre or?
I feel that I have more time now as a judge. I'm currently in a position where it is very much 8 to 4:30 every day. So again, unlike England, we get in court at 8 o'clock in the morning sharp.
Is that when your first case is?
I've got cases starting today at 8 o'clock.
See, we don't start till 10.
I'm aware, and I wonder how on earth you get anything done around.
And we finish at 4. Well,
so I start at 8 and I finish at 4:30. And during that 8 to 4:30 is very much a pressure cooker. Mm. Now I will get cases that require attention off hours. And I'm happy to do that because that's just part of the service, and I enjoy it. I enjoy digging into more difficult issues and trying to resolve them and put together a thoughtful opinion. What I found is that as a judge now, I want to give back more. Mm-hmm. So I do a lot of teaching at our local college, and I'm teaching in the criminal justice program and the legal assistant program. I also teach at a law school over in Omaha, English advocacy there. And so I find that that has been one area where I can get a more rounded experience for myself and for my students. So that fills up a lot of my free time. But I'm happy to do so because I take a lot of joy in that.
Very rewarding, isn't it, as well, when you have students, especially if they ask a question and you can answer it, I find.
Yeah, well, sometimes I'm often perplexed, just like you, like, I think I know what the answer is. And maybe I'll give something that resembles the right answer, but I'm probably going to look that up after class. So.
Sorry to sort of go back to your day to day. Are most of your decisions, your judgments, you know, given as we would say, on, you know, immediately on the hoof, or do you have, are you given time to, on some cases, to give, you know, a reasoned written judgment?
It depends on the issue. If I know how I'm going to rule, even on something that is very consequential to the case, I will deliver it directly from the bench to the parties. There are a number of times when I have to ruminate over the issues more and write an opinion, especially if it's something that's one of first impression or something that's new and novel, or the facts are nuanced enough that I really need to understand those and get a handle on them. And I have time to do that. Child welfare cases in particular require me to put out a written opinion. And there's a lot of evidence in those cases. And you want to take a thoughtful approach to that because you are in many cases separating parents from their children. And so you have to take time with it and make sure that you get it right.
Yeah.
And it's not always easy. And in fact, that is a very difficult area of law. And it's one that where I find a great deal of satisfaction, but it is also, those are the cases that keep me up at night more than anything else.
I can say those must be incredibly stressful. And in England, bizarrely, the construction judges, when it was the official referees court, also used to do the complex child cases. And so when I was just starting, there were judges that I knew that would do. And I remember talking to them at the time and saying, you know, and them saying how difficult they were, because they would generally be sort of landed them urgent matters on a Friday. They might have some papers on the Thursday night, but often you got really complex matters. So, yeah, it's a very difficult area of law in every respect. What's next for you? What's the next rung up the judicial ladder?
Well, I could go into the district court, which is just a level higher than where I am. We have three trial courts in my jurisdiction: district, district associate, and magistrate. And I sit right in the middle, which is a pretty good place to be. District is immediately above me. The district court judges tend to handle divorces more than anything else.
Right.
Sometimes some very big and complex civil litigation, and we have a few specialty courts, but they're nothing to the extent like you have with the high court. And then we have a court of appeals and a Supreme Court, and I can work myself up the ladder. I'm pretty happy where I am right now. I enjoy the work. I look forward to coming in to work, and so I'll stick where I am right now and see if the opportunity comes up and if the interest is there for me.
It's an interesting thing, isn't it? The way in which English courts have specialized, in that we now have family judges, construction, we have intellectual property court, we have corporate type court, we have maritime court. I mean, there's pretty much anything you can think of. We've gone into specialisms, and yet that tends to be in London. If you go into the district registries, there tends to be a greater crossover of judges until they've built up their specialty. But yeah, it's an interesting contrast with your approach. Brendan, I know you are, we have limited time because I know you've got to go and actually now do some real work instead of chatting with me. It's been lovely to see you for a start.
Likewise.
And catch up. This has all been about work. And it's really lovely. I'm in great admiration of you because of the fact that you chose to cross-qualify, which I don't think 99% of people realise how difficult that is, time-consuming, and the effort and the pressure, even though you did it for fun, that you put yourself under. I take my hat off to you that you did it. But also your desire. I love that, your desire to find out more about another jurisdiction and to encourage us to do so. And until, you know, I'd met you, I hadn't really thought about the benefits of that. And yet there's so much to be gained from that, and encouraging our younger lawyers to look at the ways they prosecute and close and the different approaches. Because, you know, who's to say one is better than the other or right or wrong?
Well, you know, Bill, I want to give a shout out to your friend, Nick Emerson, who, you know, was the former president of the Law Society. When I went to my ceremony I met Nick, and he shook my hand, and he heard my accent, and we talked a little bit there on stage. And he told me that he qualified in California. And I asked him, "Oh, do you have a practice there?" And he says, "No, I just wanted to see if I could do it."
Yeah.
And so, you know, Nick knows the benefit of that, and so it's comforting to me that I'm not crazy.
No, you're definitely not crazy.
That there are other people out there, especially people who have wonderful established careers like Nick, who also at least think that learning a new law can benefit your career in other ways. So I say this, Bill, in the hope that maybe you will sit for the California
bar exam one of these days.
Well, and, perhaps I'll go and look that up and see what's required. You know, and yeah, you know, it would be a great thing, as you say, and challenging. My brain could probably do with a decent challenge. Brendan, being lovely to speak to you, thank you so much for giving of your time this morning. I know you've got a busy day in front of you. I hope that we haven't taken too much time up or worn you out. I hope all the cases go really well, and that all the decisions that you give are ones that don't cause you a lot of stress and anguish or anything else.
Thank you,
and
Bill.
I look forward to seeing you very soon. Hopefully in October when you come over to Middle Temple. And don't forget to bring your hot sauce, and I'll bring some honey.
That would be great. I'm looking forward to that. Thank you for this invitation, Bill.
It's a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you for joining me for today's Barton Legal podcast. Please make sure you follow the show in your podcast app to get new episodes as soon as they're released. We'll be tackling another important topic in this month's Barton Legal webinar, and you can register for free and watch back our previous webinars at bartonlegal.com. Why don't you connect with me on LinkedIn and follow Barton Legal to keep up to date with all the legal trends and news? I look forward to speaking to you again in the next Barton Legal podcast.